have predetermined which candidates and parties are acceptable for the rest of us to choose among. It goes a lot beyond simply, that's as if that were not bad enough. And you think about it, when you think about the environmental regulations and workplace regulations that will be rolled back once these people get elected, that's what's really scary. We do have a few more headlines. The Great Recession was a total surprise that left plutocrats gobsmacked sideways. We'll have a look at this lovely bridge. Once upon a time, the prosperity of the upper classes depended upon and to some degree underwrote the prosperity of the American middle class. Not so much now, since 2008. I love it. Now they've taken, mainstream media has taken to capitalizing the Great Recession, a totally fabricated, fast track of funneling more money to the very wealthiest people in the nation. The century-old farmhouse is being demolished near Pendleton to allow workers to, wait for it, clean up the 5,000 gallons of diesel fuel spilled in an accident last month. There's more from around Cascadia. Don't know how we're going to fit all of this into the show, but right now, let's talk with Jeff about this recent Supreme Court decision. Good morning, Jeff, and thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Well, once again, Montana leading the charge. This is, it's bad enough that we've just lost all semblance of a democracy, all of it. And while at the same time, galloping around the world, loudly proclaiming our many successes of establishing democratic institutions in countries far and wide. And here, what we've done is kick out everything supporting honest elections and established a pure plutocracy. Can you briefly tell listeners what some of the darker corners are that we may not have thought of yet? Because this is going to go very deep and it very, very far reaching.
Well, the decision certainly was expected and bad news. The direct impact may not be quite as extreme. We already have the money flowing in through backdoor channels. This is actually opening up the front door. But the precedent that's set is the most disturbing thing, of the court continuing to ignore the basis of the First Amendment to go on a crusade to reshape election law and their specific preferences. This has been, going on for the past several years. So the court is not, taking a dramatically different turn here. It's proceeding down the same road. And we've, for years, have been supporting calls for amending the Constitution to make clear that the First Amendment does not mean money is the same thing as free speech, and that corporations do not have rights under the Constitution. So, our hope is that as the court continues to march to an ever more extreme end, well away from public opinion, that more and more people wake up to this need, that we need to stop holding out hope for particular politicians to change the justices on the court, and we need to take things into our own hands and demand an amendment to permanently insert into the Constitution the fundamental rights that are inherent in having a democratic republic.
Well, a couple of other things that concern me. We know that the Republicans have been quietly and persistently gone about the process of gerrymandering, and that the resulting redistricting mess has virtually guaranteed that Democrats are going to have a very tough road to hoe to get elected in many areas. Texas, of course, springs to mind. So the gerrymandering now this. The floodgates opening on that side of things. It seems that we're going to have some rather dangerous people getting themselves elected to powerful positions, where they will be able to roll back For one thing, weaken or abolish the Environmental Protection Agency, and do serious damage to various workplace regulations, other things of that sort. Have you seen any indication of that those sorts of events being in the works?
Sure. Well, of course, the people who have the capacity to make the 5, 6, and even 7-figure contributions that the Supreme Court, now permits in terms of aggregate contributions to federal candidates and political party committees, you know, those folks are not supporting a particular political party just on general altruism or because they have such a deep belief in their principles. They're looking for specific policies to be enacted or not enacted, or laws to be enforced or not enforced to advance their interests. And that's why, you know, a group that many people may not think immediately as one that would be involved in this issue, the American Independent Business Alliance, is deeply concerned about it, because the small independent businesses that make up, you know, 99% of the tens of millions of small business in America, they do not have the ability to make giant campaign contributions. They're working to make ends meet and feed their families and take care of basic needs. It's the executives and lobbyists with a few of the largest corporations that have this ability. And when they make those political investments, the return on their investment is quite obvious. They're getting direct subsidies. They're seeing antitrust laws not actively enforced, so that monopolies and oligopolies are strengthening in many different industries. So that's directly harming the ability of existing small businesses to compete successfully and fairly, and it's harming the ability of new businesses to form and new entrepreneurs to be able to start their own business when these political contributions are used to create barriers to entry. So that's why, you know, we're directly involved in this, and why, for the sake of fair competition and the ability of small businesses to compete on a level playing field, we need to eliminate this ability to readily translate wealth into political power.
Thank you so much for that. We're pretty much close to out of time here today. Can you tell listeners a little bit about your organization, how you got involved,
sure,
and how they can look at what's going on in Montana, especially some of us here in Portland who are running their own small enterprise or are thinking about it, how to go forward in this climate?
Yeah, just to be clear, we're a national network,
yes,
even though we happen to be based in Montana, and there are 80-plus affiliated organizations at the community level around the country. This includes By Vancouver USA in Clark County, the Corvallis Independent Business Alliance. Unfortunately, there's not yet an organization in Portland, but we've certainly have had interest and would love to communicate with anyone looking to help get something going. So at the community level, what we're doing is providing tools and resources and ongoing support to help communities organize independent business alliances that are about promoting the benefits of doing business locally, making sure that local law and policy is friendly to small businesses, and that there aren't things like major corporate subsidies and tax breaks being given out.
That's all. Jeff, we're flat out of time now. I can hear the theme music coming up. I apologize for that, and I want to thank you very much for being with us today. My guest has been Jeff Bilchin, co-founder of the Montana-based American Independent Business Alliance. Today, Kate Welch engineered the show for us. Thanks, Kate. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts, know your rights, take a stand. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned.
Flashpoints, the Supreme Court, I guess, now puts up for sale all federal elections. Some call it Citizens United on steroids. Also, how U.S. hardliners continue to try and sabotage ongoing nuclear talks between the U.S. and Iran. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. This is your Daily Investigative News Magazine, and we are delighted to have in the studio with us Gareth Porter. He's an investigative historian and journalist specializing in U.S. national security policy. He received the UK-based Gellhorn Prize for Journalism for 2011 for articles on the U.S. war in Afghanistan. His new book is Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. Gareth Porter, welcome into the studios and welcome back to the station.
Thanks so much, Dennis. Glad to be back again.
Good to have you back. Was looking in your most recent piece for Interpress Service. It also appeared on Consortium News, A Poison Pill for Iran Nuke Talks. And essentially, you're still fighting this battle to call attention to the fact there is a crew of folks, right-wing folks in this country, who do not want these talks to go forward. Maybe you could set this up for us.
Yes, indeed. This latest piece is actually, you know, it's a revelation that I essentially learned about only after I began to really look into what was being said by whom about this whole question of the so-called possible military dimensions, which is a reference to the accusations that Iran had a covert nuclear weapons program. Certainly 2001, 2003 has been the accusation, and some state that they still were working on nuclear weapons beyond 2003. And these were documents and intelligence reports that were published by the International Atomic Energy Agency and given great credibility for most readers of newspapers and watchers of television. So my task that I gave myself was to figure out, okay, who was saying what in various publications in this country about the question of what should the Obama administration's position be toward this issue in the nuclear talks. And what I found was that it was all of the organizations that are supportive of the Israeli line, that is to say the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, etc., who were saying consistently that the United States should demand that Iran actually admit, make a confession. A public confession that, in fact, it had this covert nuclear weapons program, and indeed go beyond a confession and give all the details of all the work
as
that they
provided
did
by the Israeli intelligence.
Well, that's right, of course.
That made it up.
As you know, and I think some of your listeners will know, I have, in my book, Manufactured Crisis, have documented the evidence that, in fact, these documents were from the Israeli Mossad, and they were fabricated. It was fabricated intelligence. But so the point, of course, of these demands coming from the Israeli line organizations was to sabotage the talks, because they knew perfectly well, of course, that this would be rejected out of hand by Iran, and that to the extent that the United States really put forward this demand seriously and tied the fate of the talks to it, which it appeared the Obama administration was doing when they briefed the news media about the joint plan of action in November, and again in more recent briefings, they've seemed to suggest that without an adequate accounting for the possible military dimensions by Iran, there could not be a final deal. So it appears that this was seen as a perfect formula for essentially causing the breakdown of the talks. Now, what happened was quite interesting. You know, it appears that Secretary of State John Kerry, when he first came into office in early 2013, picked up the originally he was ready to just say to the Iranians, we want you to essentially take a position that would facilitate, you know, our reaching agreement, but he did not talk about anything like making a confession. There was no come clean sort of language.
Yeah, can't you see him falling over to come clean to a story created by Mossad?
But yeah, we did it.
What's interesting is that in October 2013, you have Kerry suddenly coming out with language about that Iran must come clean. And that's just on the eve of the key round of negotiations with Iran on the nuclear issue. So it looks like, you know, there was some response to, you know, conversations with the Israelis. And the Israelis, as you know, perhaps are always, there are talks, intensive talks with the Israelis, conversations about what position the United States will take in the next round of talks every time that there's a new round that happens. So clearly that's what was going on there. But when they got to the final round of talks in November, it appears that the negotiators realized that they couldn't possibly ask the Iranians to come clean in the joint plan of action or to adumbrate that at all. And so instead the language was really much more indirect, and it was simply that there should be a resolution of concerns. So that gives the administration plenty of room for maneuver. We don't know what they're going to do about this, but at this point it looks like they're not tied down to the Israeli position that would indeed have sabotaged the talks.
Well, remind us where the talks are now.
Well,
Where are we at this point?
At this point, they are holding monthly meetings, which generally last 3 days and that are at the level of undersecretary or deputy minister of foreign affairs on the two sides of the United States and Iran.
So it's a second or a third in command doing this.
That's right, exactly. But in between those monthly meetings, there are constant conversations, constant negotiations, in effect, on details of the issues that they're supposed to be covering in these monthly meetings. So hopefully, you know, one hopes that these technical conversations, these technical exchanges constantly going on, are in fact softening up the process of meeting in person between the